And this KBOO program, The Bike Show, has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. It's open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.com.
You've just tuned in to The Bike Show, broadcast live from the KBOO studios in Southeast Portland, Oregon. I'm Meg Keyes, here with fellow co-host Alon Robb. Good morning, Alon. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning to you, and a special hello to Jim, Jenny, Yashin, and also a get well to Sean, who had a bicycle accident. So get back on that bike, Sean.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry to hear about that. So as those leaves are starting to change and all the children of the world are heading back to school, and those are those of us with end of season colds like myself, have them growing stronger. We are here at the KBOO Bike Show and want to take a moment to reflect on some of the wonderful summer adventures that have occurred on the two wheels. I know I personally enjoyed some stellar bike rides locally, whether they were through Petalpalooza or Mountain Bike Oregon in Oak Ridge, or just recently I was up in Alaska doing some small trails up there. But my adventures weren't as grand as others. So today we've asked two really rad adventure cyclists to join us and tell us what they did this summer. In the first half of the show, we will be joined by Jasmine Reese. She's the founder of Fijipaw, who is adventuring around the world with her violin and her pup, Fiji. On the second half of the show, we will be joined with Spencer Harding, who's an adventure photographer and organizer of this summer's ride, hashtag DFL The Divide, a social media organized event that popped up on some glorious photos along many people's Instagram feeds. And he'll be able to tell us whether or not that 10-day ride was as beautiful as it looked. We have Jasmine joining us momentarily on the line, and she's been cycling around the U.S. and Canada for the last 6 months, and then I think she plans to head international soon, but she's not alone with her travels. She is joined by her trusty pup, Fiji, and her violin, and she's spreading her music along the road. Welcome to the show, Jasmine.
Hi!
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm actually at a farmer's market right now. I just got done playing and made some change, so I'm pretty happy about that.
Awesome. And so where is the farmer's market you're at? Are you in Canada?
I'm in Ontario, Kenora, Ontario, and there's a big farmer's market happening right now, and they were nice enough to let me play, and people were pretty receptive to it. I'm still getting used to playing by myself and making myself sound entertaining enough to draw in people, but it worked here today.
And I think this is Alon, the co-host. Good morning. And I think this is the first time we had a guest speaking from Canada, so thank you for making our show go international.
Oh, well, I just want to put it out there that I'm not from Canada, but I am... cycling across Canada at the moment. I'm from Los Angeles, California, originally. So
I love it. And so you've been out on the road for 6 months now, correct?
Yes, 6 months. It was 6 months September 1st.
Exciting. And how's it going? I mean, so this is your second trip out. You did one in 2013.
Yes.
And so you're out now.
Yeah, the one in... 2013 was kind of an ego booster. This one's more chasing after an unrequited dream. This one is a lifestyle. I've kind of given up Oh, thank you so much. I've given up my, you know, my worldly or material belongings, and I'm living on the road, and I'm letting the road kind of be my teacher. And so I've been meeting tons of people, and just now while we were talking, there was a man who just set some money down after hearing me play and said, get some coffee. So that's kind of been my summer, is people just showing that they're kind and good, and I haven't had any bad experiences. And so that's kind of what's been happening this summer.
That's awesome. And so, you know, do you have any specific favorite memories of your adventures so far?
You know, nothing like, well, that's not true. thank you so much. Sorry about that, you guys.
I kind of love that. I love the interactive. I'm with you.
So amazing.
I'm with you in the farmer's market right now.
Yeah, I'm in the farmer's market still. So yeah, I think that's probably my favorite experience, is just the fact that people come through at these really amazing moments when I'm thinking, oh, I don't know where I'm going to stay. I don't know what I'm going to eat. I don't know what I'm going to do. And then all of a sudden there's just like this wonderful person that appears in front of me and says, hey, come stay at my house, or come eat with me, or whatever the case may be. And that's pretty awesome. But besides that, I've also had wonderful musical opportunities this trip around. Like I said, I'm chasing after an unrequited dream, and that's to be a violinist. And so I've met tons of musicians. I participated in my first fiddle competition in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, in Canada.
Ooh, did you win?
I won fifth place. I got fifth place. It was the John Arcan Fiddle Fest, so I was really excited about I'll tell you what happened. So I hitchhiked up off my route and went up to Saskatoon, and I actually hitchhiked with a pastor who was picking up kids from Bible camp, and was able to stay with a host there in Saskatoon. And I pulled in, and there was the preliminaries, and I said, you know what, I'm going to do this. So I learned three fiddle tunes, and I said, you know, I'm not going to need to learn six, because I'm not going to make it to the finals. This is no way. You know, I'm competing against really great fiddlers who've been practicing their pieces for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Because you're more of a classically trained violinist as opposed to a fiddler. Like, those are
Yeah, and I'm more classically trained, too. So even if I can learn the pieces, I'm not going to sound what the class. I'm not going to sound the old-timey fiddly sound that you're supposed to have. So I learned the fiddle tunes, played the preliminaries, and I went back to my host house and said, okay, I'll start packing up because I'm not going to go to the finals tomorrow. And then I got a call about 6 o'clock at night, and they said, you made it to the finals. And I just went, oh, my gosh, I have to learn three other tunes. So that was pretty awesome to have that experience, though. So I learned three other tunes and got fifth place and won
$50. That's awesome.
And you're traveling with Fiji. Could you tell us a little bit about this companion cyclist cycling dog?
Yeah, so Fiji is a remarkable dog who's pretty fearless she's very stuck to me. I'm her home center, and so it's an honor to be able to spend nearly 24/7 with her and to form this type of bond that we really rely on each other. She relies on me to protect her, and I also rely on her to protect me. But on top of that, we're partners when we're riding. She runs about 40 kilometers per day.
Wow.
She has Boxer, Whippet, and Basenji. So that's about 25 miles per day. And, wow. Go ahead.
So she's alongside you as well as in the trailer during your daily ride?
Yeah, so I pull a trailer behind me, which she gets in, and we're taking tons of breaks during the day. She's drinking tons of water. So it's an effort, and we're stopping a lot. But the fact that she can run and kind of do some of the work helps me to get from point A to point B. I think traveling without her would have put a completely different dynamic to what I'm doing, because I would have had twice the work. But she's so great at pulling the bicycle. So sometimes when we're on flat land, we're flying because she's pulling. So,
oh, that's awesome.
So that's nice. So it's just amazing that she's able to work. She's not afraid of things as long as I'm with her. She isn't afraid of thunderstorms or and she's socialized. She's very nice, and she loves people. And the fact that we can go into people's homes and she doesn't pee on the carpet or anything like that, and that she's this well-behaved dog that I can take with me, and people love her. It's so satisfying to have that type of relationship where I can actually bring my dog with me.
Yeah, that's
I think
amazing.
I hear her in the background every once in a while, or is that just my imagination?
That's your imagination. I didn't bring Fiji out here with me today because she does have one behavioral trait that I haven't quite trained her out of yet. Whenever someone's reaching down to the violin case to put money in, she growls at them.
So you can work that into your act somehow, right?
They're paying for your dog.
Yeah, I have to admit, my dog is a mini version of Fiji.
Oh, really?
Yes, and just, you know, much tinier, but the brindle and same face and everything. It's so funny. So when I look at your photos, I'm like, there's no way I could take Bruiser out on the road with me like that. He just would not have it. He can do like maybe max 30 minutes out on the road, and that's about it. So it's impressive.
Well, you know, every dog is. And I tell that to people, too. I said, just because Fiji's doing it doesn't mean every dog can do it, because each dog is an individual, and they have their own exercise limits and their own personalities about what they can take, what scares them. You know, Fiji, we get passed by semi-trucks every day, and it doesn't faze Fiji. But another dog might be really scared to hear that loud noise coming up on the side of them. So, you know, so it's kind of like you need to assess whether your dog can travel in this way and whether they're socialized enough. And Fiji just happens to be this wonderful dog that can handle this type of travel. So that's wonderful for me.
And how did you start riding? You mentioned a previous trip. Did you ride when you were younger, as a child?
No. No, it was very much spontaneous. I was kind of in a point in my life where I wanted to prove to myself and give myself a confidence boost and say that I could do something pretty extraordinary. Bicycling across the country just kind of came about as something that if I could do that with no experience, mm-hmm. being a chubby city girl, then I can, you know, do anything I put my mind to. Mm. So cycling kind of came about because I gained more than the freshman 15. I gained like the freshman 60. And then that wasn't in the freshman year. It was just all throughout college. And so I started bicycling to lose weight and also get myself to go to classes. And I was going every day, and it was hard. There would just be small hills that I couldn't get up. I had to walk up them. And then finally, one day, I was just riding them. And I started asking myself questions like, oh, I wonder how far a bicycle can go. And Facebook, which magically puts those ads in front of you sometimes, showed adventurecycling.org showed up on one of the Facebook ads, and I ended up clicking on that and seeing all these cool stories about people who have bicycled cross country, and so I of course wanted to do that. But then of course I had my dog Fiji, and we had this wonderful bond where we were inseparable, and so there's no way she was going to not come with me. So I started doing research on whether people have taken their dogs on trips like that, and we started to work on it, and I think I decided to go in January of that year and left in May. So not much preparation. We just kind of left. I actually had never rode a loaded bicycle before, so I had never put the bags on there or the trailer. We set everything up on the first day out in New York. Yeah.
You left in New York too?
Yes. My mom actually drove me out to New York. We were in Columbia, Missouri. And I said, it has to be cross country. It can't be half country. It has to be cross country.
Yeah.
And my mom was kind of against it. She said, well, you know, no, you're not going to do this. You can't do this. This is insane sort of deal. And so I said, okay. So I went downstairs and I was on Craigslist, and I came back up to my mom and I said, oh, there's two guys in a pickup. They look pretty cool. I think I'm going to head out there with them. And then she decided she would take me to New York. So.
I love it. I love that this was your drive. I know I have to admit that I feel kind of a kindred spirit in you, like that I myself kind of did something similar where I was like, not, you know, I'm not a stereotypical cycling body. I am a thicker person, and I decided that I needed to feel empowered, and, you know, I think I took a week to plan a trip on a 3-speed Schwobo through Canada, and hadn't ever really done more than 40 miles and definitely wasn't loaded. And I practiced up the Palisades in New York because I was living in Brooklyn at the time. And I got a lot of looks, and I got a lot of – some people cheered. Some people were kind of like, what is this girl doing? And so I was just curious, do you find that as you're along the road on your trips? Like, are there people – because you have a dog and a violin and a trailer, and, you know, are you...
Yeah, I have... I think I don't fit the profile of a normal cyclist, so I, you know, I'm a bigger girl on a bicycle. People usually, the comment out here is when they meet me, they said, oh, I was expecting a, you know, a skinny girl.
Do people really say that?
Yeah, people say that. They're really upfront about it, and I don't take it personally, because I actually can see why they would think that. You know, the profile of cyclists is, are these skinnier, especially if you're looking at like road cyclists or people who are doing triathlons and things like that. So there's an idea in their mind of what a cyclist looks like. So I don't take offense at all.
Yeah.
And I'm just happy that I can defy that image that they have in their mind and put a new image there. So, I show up, and I'm usually a chubbier girl. I have a dog, and I'm pulling a massive amount of weight. And usually bicycle tourists want to be as minimal as possible and try to, you know, minimize their weight. So I'm just this crazy girl with no experience pulling almost 140 pounds in weight up hills.
Well, I don't think you're allowed to say you have no experience anymore after 6 months.
Yeah, Yeah, that's true. In this context, I probably don't. I shouldn't say that anymore.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that I've never been outside of the country. So, other than that.
But that's coming, right?
Yeah.
That's a good segue into where are you going next?
I know. So Canada, and then I'm bicycling down Maine to Florida, and then I hope to work at a bicycle shop for a couple of months, and then a violin shop. And then after that, I'm going to try to follow in the footsteps of some other cyclists and not travel via plane. So I'm going to hitchhike or sail hike across the ocean, either via commercial ships or through people who are actually sailing. So that's how Fiji and I are going to get across the ocean to Asia. And then it'll be Europe after Asia, Africa, and then another ship to South America. And then hopefully no more ships after that.
Yeah.
And then the last place is Antarctica or the moon.
If I go to Antarctica, I'm going to have to keep Fiji home. And the idea of not traveling with Fiji is not something I've ever considered. So if Fiji can't go there, then we most likely won't be going there, which is why it's only 5 continents in total as opposed to, you know, all 7. Right now, Fiji, she can't go to Australia because Australia has some pretty strict pet import laws. And we're not going to a couple other countries as well because of the pet import laws. Mm. So if Fiji can't go there, then I don't go there.
Well, as far as preconceived ideas that people might have about you, I like the, you know, your wonderful website. I really like the sections, Random Acts of Kindness, and also the section where you talk about don't judge a book by its covers. So I'm wondering what you know, how did this trip change your worldview, if at all?
Sure. That's a great question because, yeah, I do have my own preconceived notions of how the world is, or I did at least, and I still do. Sometimes I still find myself judging how a certain situation is going to turn out, and it's completely opposite of what I thought. So when I first left on my New York to San Diego tour, I thought I was really going to have to rough it. I didn't think I could ask people for help. I thought I was going to be on my own, have to dumpster dive for food. And that was just going to be the challenge of that great adventure. But people surprised me. I mean, out of that 6 months that I was on the road, I only had to camp 3 times. And that was because, and the 3 times that I did have to camp was because there were no homes. So people couldn't offer their homes.
Because you were just out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, I wasn't out in the middle of nowhere. So if I hadn't been out in the middle of nowhere for those 3 days, I would have had a place to stay. People, and you know, there's wonderful resources like warm showers and couch surfing and wolfing and workaway, all these wonderful resources. But the places that I was staying was not from these websites most of the time. Most of the time it was just people I met on the street who, after talking to me for some time, said, you know what, why don't you come home with me? You know, so the fact that so many people trusted me and my dog to come into their home while only having met me 5 minutes ago. I don't know, it just kind of restored some type of faith in humanity. It also made me feel less isolated in the world. I feel like our Earth is a community of people. We're not, you know, living in our own world. And so the idea that we can go to each other, even if we don't know each other, for help and ask each other for help is something that I'm trying to cultivate every day and realize that people are there for people. People are there for people. And you should never feel like, you know, if you run up to someone and you're really in a bind, that you can't lay your emotions out and tell people that. And I'm not saying people should offer their homes or their food or their money. That's not what I'm talking about. But the idea that we can talk to people and that we can create communities and connections with people that we've just met only 5 minutes ago, that is something that's possible, and we should never be afraid of that. I think thinking that people are distant and separated from us is the wrong way to think. So that's kind of how my worldview has changed. And then, of course, just some normal things that people tend to judge people by. I met a man named Zin Ben who, you know, based on the stereotypes that were taught from an early age, I thought he was going to be completely different than what he was, and he ended up being like a philosopher and an astronomer and an artist and a musician, and I thought he was going to be like, you know, the uneducated kind of guy by the way he initially presented himself. And so I had to kind of pat myself hit myself on my hand and say, Dad, then why did you judge this person by the cover? Because that's kind of what people do to you when you pull up as a chubby cyclist, you know? So people say, you know, how is she cycling from here to there when she's got all this weight on her? And so I'm judging this person based on his looks, and that's not appropriate. So I've learned not to do that. And I've learned to look at people who, even though I look at them and maybe I'll take a step back, I kind of have to say, oh, wait, why am I taking a step back? That person just smiled at me. So what fears am I, from my education or brainwashing, am I putting on him, you know, or her? So yeah, that's something I've learned now.
That's so wonderful. I am feeling inspired now. I appreciate, you know, the kind of, the focus on kindness in which you're traveling, and I think that you're right that kind of just, you know, downloading the like our barriers and our boundaries a little sometimes can open up to greatness. You know, one of the things on your website as well, you talk a little bit about poverty and, you know, not having money. And I think I overheard an interview that you did where you talked about, you know, your first bike was just a cheap Walmart bike. So why did you pick up such a expensive hobby, two expensive hobbies if you consider the violin, and how does that work? Like, you know, do you have, what's going on with your gear? Like,
yeah, so I don't, you know, I don't see it as expensive. I saw the initial investment as expensive, but even then I kind of went to companies and I laid my heart out and I said, this is what I'm about to do, and I can advertise for you, would you guys give me discounts and things like that. So I got a lot of my equipment highly discounted, or some of it for free. So I didn't even have to make too much of a big investment up front. And then now out on the road, the act of cycling is completely different. If I had chosen to take a car, I don't have gas prices. With resources like couch surfing and warm showers and stopping at churches and camping with a tent and sleeping bag, I don't have accommodation charges. Except for every once in a while when I decide, oh, I need a motel so I can have some modern conveniences. But for the most part, you know, I don't have those expenses. And that comes from a lot of research. And I think the way I'm traveling is not luxurious by any means. If I had decided to go out and stay in a motel every day and be in kind of a luxurious vacation where I made things easy on myself, then yeah, for sure, it'd be an expensive hobby. But I've kind of chosen a cheap, uncomfortable way to travel so that I could get from one place to the next and have these wonderful experiences. So I've sacrificed a lot in lifestyle and luxury so that I can actually have meaningful experiences, if that makes any sense.
No, it totally does.
And when you travel, what kind of gear do you travel with? I mean, just a short technical question here.
What 100% thing do you have to have with you?
Well, bicycle number one.
Yes, that's true.
And, you know, the bicycle was important to me when I first started researching which bicycle I was going to take. I wanted a bicycle that wasn't going to break under the pressure. So, you know, I'm a bigger girl. Plus, I was going to be carrying my dog, a trailer, plus other gear was going to be on that bicycle. So this bicycle can't just be out for 3,000 miles and then all of a sudden it's destroyed and I need to get a new one.
Yeah.
So I decided to go with the Kona Sutra because it's made out of steel and it's just a really amazing touring bike. It's very powerful and I've put so much weight on that bike. And it's still going strong, 6,000 miles later. So the fact that bicycle has carried so much of me and emotionally and physically and everything is something that I value. Of course, Phoebe's trailer because she can't run the whole time, so I have to pull her. Right now I'm cycling with the cycle tote trailer. And that's really, it's inconvenient because it doesn't fold down or anything. So if I do need to take an emergency ride, or hitchhike or something like that in order to get out of inclement weather or whatever situation.
The whole rig
happening.
Has to go on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
So well, if I need to get out of that, if I need to get out of a situation, I can't fold it down. So it can only fit in certain types of cars. But that trailer has not had any issues. No breakdowns,
awesome.
No flat tires, nothing. So it's a pretty powerful trailer.
That's great.
And then, of course, you need panniers. I've decided that I'm going to be on the road for 6 years and I'm going to have all these amazing memories, so I have to have a camera.
Yeah.
And then I also need to be self-sufficient and try to get jobs, and remote jobs are the easiest thing I can think of. So I also invested in a laptop so that I could work from the road, and of course my violin, but I didn't pay any money for that because I've had it for a long time. And then clothes. I carry about two pairs of clothing and I change those out when they get worn or torn. Like right now I have 7 holes in my pants and I've sewed them as much as possible. But I think it's going to be time for a new pair of pants.
Awesome. So, I pulled up a little clip of some of your violin that we're going to play in a minute. It was the Pink Eye Lament. And I believe that you performed it with a gentleman that you had mentioned earlier in the show, Zen Ben. And I think the clip said it was somewhere in the Grand Old Container. Where were you when this was?
Okay, so hold on just a second because there's a nice helicopter going over.
Okay. Well, and then also too, we're running a little low on our segment here, so if you want to also plug how people can find out more about you and follow you on your journey in that same vein would be great, and then we'll run into the clip.
Awesome. So do you want me to tell you about Zen Ben?
Where was the performance? Like where along your travels in Canada?
So the Grand Old Container was his house. He turned a shipping container into a home.
Awesome.
So it was a solar. Yeah.
And then if people want to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you or like follow your travels?
FIJAPAW.com. That stands for Fiji and Jasmine Pedal Around the World.
Awesome. And then we're going to cue up the music here, and I'm just going to thank you greatly for coming along and letting us interview you. And safe travels, and I'm going to keep following you because you're just so inspiring, and it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you so much.
Safe travels. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. To the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland and on the web at www.kboo.fm. Please stay tuned with us for the second half of our show, where we learn about some wonderful summer adventures with Spencer Harding of hashtag DFL The Divide. Hello, Spencer there. Well, while we're waiting for Spencer, I will just make a little quick intro here. Now we are joining with Spencer shortly, and he is the organizer of a summer bike ride called hashtag DFL The Divide. And yes, I say hashtag as part of the title, since he was predominantly arranging it on Instagram. Spencer himself is an adventure photographer, and he set to the internet to get a group of other cyclists and photographers together to bike from Banff to Missoula for the Adventure Cycling's 40th anniversary party. The photos are quite spectacular, hilarious, and, well, hot. While I have a bit of skepticism that most people are having that much fun on the internet all the time, this ride really looked to be jam-packed with attractive bike rigs, stunning scenes, strong ladies who wear trail dirt well, pretty bearded boys, and everyone maneuvering their bikes through the Great Divide mountain bike trail looked to be having a blast. And hopefully Spencer can fill us in on whether or not the internet lied to us or it was all that it was cracked up to be. So we'll welcome Spencer to the show now. Are you there?
Hey, hi, hello.
Hey, so you're joining us from Canada, am I correct?
No, I'm actually in Oakland now.
Oh, you're in Oakland. Okay. Earlier, I thought you were going to be in Canada. Sorry about that. I thought we were going to have double whammy of two people in Canada today.
Close. It was like a day and a half ago I was in Canada.
Okay. Gotcha. So how did you come up with this concept to do the Divide Tour trip and just kind of advertise it, you know, social media-wise?
So I guess to set the scene, it was me and my buddy Kurt and another friend Miles from Los Angeles. We were bike touring in Colombia last fall, and I'd finally gotten my updated schedule for like the whole year of 2016, and I got really excited because I knew when I actually had time off. And me and Kurt were sitting around the fire talking about, he was getting really excited about the Adventure Cycling's 40th anniversary. I was like, we got to get there somehow. And he's like, we should just ride the Great Divide route to there. And then it just kind of, like, snowballed from there. I'm like, yeah, like, I had ridden part of that route with him a few years back, and I had missed the Canada section, which I was really excited about. So, yeah, we just kind of, like, said, like, let's do this route, and then we put a blast out to, like, 10 people that we knew or kind of knew or were in that kind of small world of bike touring on the Instagram world, and it just snowballed from there.
Yeah. And then, so how many people eventually showed up?
We'll see. There was probably total like 24 of us. So Kyle and Liz from Los Angeles took off a few days early, and we never wound up catching them.
No.
on July 5th, I think like 16 of us took off from Banff, and then on the 6th, another 4 or 5 took off. They were waiting up for this wonderful human, Mark Reimer, to show up. So they caught us in like a day and a half. So I think at our full strength, we were somewhere in the low 20s. And then we kind of snowballed a few other humans on the way as well. Morgan and Stephanie from Canada were on their own little crazy summer adventure, and they met up with us right around the border.
Did they know about the ride, or were they just casually out on their own?
They knew we were like close, and we were kind of planning to intersect. I know Morgan from the internet, of course, and biked with him last summer up in Canada. So they knew like generally where we were going to be, but at that point the group had kind of splintered into like a small group of 3 and like a big group of like 18, and then they met with the small group of 3, and then we all coalesced again finally in Whitefish. And
Good morning. This is Alon, the co-host.
Hi, Alon.
Hi. How is it to ride in Canada? Is there any difference? I mean, some people in the United States think Canada is another universe. Is there any difference as far as conditions, the people you meet, the response than in the U.S.?
Oh, I mean, Canadians are just really nice. Benedict would tell you there's a lack of fancy food co-ops, which he was very upset about because he couldn't get fancy yogurt as much as he would like.
And this is somebody that was on the ride?
Yeah, this is Benedict of Ultra Romance fame on Instagram if you're following along with his very beautiful adventures. But other than that, especially the route, we were only in Canada for like half the time. Mm-hmm. And it's like barely over the border, I guess. But as far as conditions go and facilities and everything like that, it's pretty much identical to what I find in the States for the most part.
So did you notice when you crossed the border? It wasn't like a drastic change.
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't notice any difference. Like, oh, wait, we all have cell reception again.
And were your fellow cyclists, did all of them have experience or were there some people new to cycling?
No one was new to cycling. It was a few people's first time doing a dirt tour, like mm-hmm. on mountain
like
bikes
bikepacking.
The entire time. Yeah, so a few people, that was their first like big foray into that besides like an overnight or two. But everyone was like pretty well seasoned on bike tour or camping or, yeah, everyone. We kind of curated is the wrong word, but we sent out to people that we knew like could be self-sufficient. Like everyone packed all their own gear. Yeah. All their own food in case we split up or spread out. So everyone was kind of in their own little bike tour world, but we were all traveling together. So you had to have a little bit of experience.
Yeah. And then I'm curious too how the trails were with that many people on them. I know there were some photos, one specifically, I can't remember who took it, but it's Todd Seeley kind of crossing a non-existent trail on a giant slope. And I'm just wondering, and there's two people behind him, and I'm wondering how staggering on a trail with that many people and that much gear worked out for everyone.
I think the section you're talking about is this one ridiculously steep, like, push a bike. It's like probably like 1,000 feet long and takes like half an hour because it's so steep. But it's a very like isolated section on the whole trail. Yeah. Most of that route is laid out to be on like 2-lane dirt roads. So it's, you know, like they're wide open roads, it's fire roads and things like that. So on those things, you can ride like 4 or 5 wide and just like chat to everyone. It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
And there's like isolated sections of single trackish things, but.
And how long?
It wasn't.
Those sections weren't that bad. They weren't that long.
Nah, it's pretty isolated on that route because it was designed to be ridden like on like touring bikes.
Yeah.
So it's not super intense. But yeah, there wasn't really like. Really, I mean, obviously that push-up bike thing was a bit of a bottleneck because everyone's bikes weighed like 60 or 80 pounds and going up this steep, loose hill. But other than that, it was never a problem.
Yeah. Was that like a day crossing for all 18 of you or was that just a morning?
It was a rough morning.
And how did you get started with cycling?
Oh, man. I bought my first bike in college. My sophomore year, instead of buying a parking pass, and then I just rode bikes to school every day. And then I met this lovely human named Allison Birch, who told me that I could go camping on my bike, and that kind of blew my mind. And from there, it kind of snowballed into just going on a bunch of adventures each summer. I think I've been on one bike adventure at least every summer since 2009 now.
Yeah. Have you noticed? I mean, I know it's kind of blowing up, like the bikepacking world is everybody's, that's what everyone wants to do. Have you noticed that, like, as you're out, like, we're just having more people to go with on your adventures?
I've definitely seen the shift of a lot more people switching to, like, more dirt-oriented adventures as opposed to, like, road stuff. But I think, yeah, the word's getting around and more people are getting interested in it and adventure cycling's putting out some new routes and, you know, they've been getting a lot more publicity, especially for, I think, the Great Divide route in the last 10 years has gotten a lot of attention, which is really wonderful. And then some smaller, lesser-known routes are popping up, like the Oregon Outback in eastern Oregon and some new trails being blazed as the Baja Divide that's happening this winter for the first time. Layla Nicholas laid out this amazing like 2,200-mile dirt route through Baja, California. So a lot of attention is being given to these kind of new dirt routes, which is super awesome.
And is that Layla Wilcox?
Yeah.
Who just came in first on the I'm going to blank on the name of the ride now.
The Trans Am.
Trans Am, thank you. I'm like, Pan? Yeah. Nope, not Pan, something.
And it's also, I mean, hearing about all these rides, it's also nice to to see the connection to early cyclists. I mean, already in 1870, people were riding around the world or across the continent, sometimes with high wheelers, you know, so it's kind of nice to have that connection. Reading a little bit about you, I also noticed that you've gone a few times around the Salton Sea. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that ride, the terrain, and also a place called Slab City, which you said was the last free place in America.
Oh, man, Slab City. me and some friends go down there once a year and have like a big friend family reunion. The trip you saw, the bikepacking trip that me, Alex, Brad and his girlfriend took was really just like a weekend adventure. We drove out to like this remote canyon, parked the car and said, okay, we're going to ride down to the slab. On the way there, we're just going to stay as close to the sea as we could and kind of just wove a little, like bunch of little goat trails and beaches and things like that. I got stuck in this gnarly bog of like rotting dead fish bones. And it was pretty much the grossest thing I'd ever like ridden my bike through.
Yum.
It was like, like an inch thick on my fat bike, and then the only dry thing was like a beach of fish bones. It was like rotting muck, like green, like swamp muck covered in like dead fish bones as I'm like rolling down this beach.
And where exactly in the U.S. is this place?
It's east of Palm Springs. So if you like look at Los Angeles and you look like 2.5 hours kind of southeast, it's this huge inland sea. I mean, I could talk for days about the Salton Sea and Slab City. You guys are into podcasts, which anyone listening probably is. 99% Invisible just did a really rad podcast on the history of the Salton Sea like a month ago. And that'd be a great little primer. But the slabs are just this crazy old military base, super fun site that a bunch of squatters took over in the desert. And it's really wonderful. If you wind up in that area, there's a hot spring, a Salvation Mountain, there's like a library, and it's just a really cool place. Everyone should go there and just see what's what, I think.
Awesome. And then, so with the hashtag DFL The Divide, do you guys plan on doing something similar again in the future?
I don't know if we'll do. I mean, the DFL The Divide thing was just kind of off the cuff that kind of got picked up by everyone, which is awesome. But I think we're already talking about next year.
Yeah.
And I actually, Whitney was just down in Oakland. I saw her yesterday. Then we hung out with Serena, who was on the trip. And then Whitney rode down to Santa Cruz for this thing she was going to. And like four of the other people who live around here like rode down with her. So there's already these like little like. It's like there were some really like amazing connections that were made this summer.
And these are all people that didn't necessarily know one another prior to meeting up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was this one guy, Oliver. He was like the tall, skinny Australian dude in the photos. He didn't know any of us. He was bike touring with his wife or partner, and he ran into one guy, Larkin, down in L.A. and started talking about this ride. And he was like, oh, yeah, like 5 or 6 people are coming. And then he wound up in San Francisco and Oakland, and went to a shop and met like 2 other people that were going on the ride too. And then like a day later ran to this guy, Colin Sacramento, who was also going.
Just serendipitously.
Serendipitously met 4 people who were doing it. Was like, I'm flying to Calgary, and just showed up.
That's awesome. And everyone got along with him.
Yeah. He's like the most wonderful human ever. If you see him ever, he's amazing. So yeah, like most people, they didn't know each other, or like we knew each other on the internet. And I had met a few people, like, in passing on other, like, the Oregon Outback last summer. A lot of us had met briefly and just through other random interactions, like, once or one degree of separation. And, yeah, it just brought everyone together, and everyone had an amazing, amazing time. And those connections are still hanging on. And I think it's just going to kind of splinter out and lead to a lot of other cool adventures and everyone getting together again.
Guest in the first part of the show, Jasmine Reese, who's traveling alone with her violin and also Fiji, the dog, spoke a little bit about, you know, preconceived ideas she had or preconceived ideas people might have had about her. This is a big philosophical question, but I'm wondering, you know, how are your views of the world changing since you first started cycling, and what have you learned about humanity? It is a big question, man. But you could say no comment, but I'm just curious, you know, just the changes that you might have noticed. Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting question, too, and when you preface the fact that, like, we just talked about the gentleman, Oliver, who showed up and didn't know anyone, you know, is it the two wheels that bring people together to get along for that, or...
I mean, it's this common thread. I mean, ever since I started bike touring, when you meet people, you're obviously coming from, like, typically, like, sometimes very different worlds, sometimes, like, the exact same world. But you're like, hey, you like bikes. I like bikes. That's cool. Let's hang out. Mm-hmm. But as far as, like, a humanity level, it's like any kind of traveling. I think you wind up in these situations where you need to lean on people that you may or may not know at all, and you get situations and you have to, like, hitchhike or, like, talk to some random person and ask for a favor or a place to stay or, like, some water. And putting yourself in those situations on a bike or otherwise is just going to lead you to realizing that, to quote Andrew Jackson Jihad, like, people are people regardless of anything. Go out in the world and, like, talk to someone you may have never interacted with otherwise, and, you know, like, just find out that people are really wonderful and they want to help, and if something goes wrong, like, someone's going to be there, and that person will probably be willing to help you and just not be afraid of the world outside as much.
And that's a wonderful message at any time, and especially this election season when fear seems to be a big theme. You know, looking a little bit about you, I mean, I'm curious about your early development, your childhood, your photography, but also I really liked what you said about traveling to Yosemite and the necessity of an annual pilgrimage for sanity. Did you grow up in an insane world? Or?
No. I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up, if you ever watched that show Weeds, like, some years back, like,
yes.
I grew up there. I grew up, like, in the original suburb, like,
oh, the one, like, on the intro where all the houses match each other, little boxes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's based on Calabasas, and I grew up in Westlake, Thousand Oaks. So I grew up, like, in a 50-tacky, like, condominium complex, like, far from insane. My parents always took me to Yosemite when I was young, which was really wonderful. And if you live in Los Angeles, like, my rule is you got to leave once a month for a weekend, and, like, 2 months out of the year, like, you have to be out of that city. Or
I have that in every city I live in.
Yeah, I don't think it's specific to L.A., but, like, people need to get out. Like, you just kind of fester. And I think it's really important to go do some kind of trip. And for me, that's been bike touring most of the time. Done a lot of backpacking as well, which transitioned nicely. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of people pushing, like, short weekend adventures. And you've seen, like, the sub-24-hour thing. If you know, in Portland, if you run into Russ and Laura, like, they're really pushing, like, go out and go, like, fishing for the weekend, or just, like, ride your bike to the hills. And they've got, like, some awesome options for that.
And that's Pathless Pedal, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think everyone's just like, you know, this is really accessible. It's super easy to just get out and just, like, pedal out of the city for a weekend, and you'll just feel better about the world when you come back. So.
And so then, you know, what was your favorite summer memory, whether it be with this ride or another ride? One of your, I feel like, because you've done more than one adventure this summer, right?
The DFL trip was definitely the main one. Okay. I take people on bike tours, so I work for, like, a van-supported vacation company.
That's what you were doing in Canada.
On the internet, but I'm actually, like, taking other people on vacation. And I'm, like, driving a van and making kale salads and, like, carrying luggage.
That sounds fun.
But my favorite memory, I'm trying to, like, lock down. So I'm looking back at the photos in my brain. There's a bunch of photos of us hanging out in this field of daisies. And we were leaving Starwood, and we had to climb this big hill, and it was in the rain. And I'm such a Southern California boy that when it rains, I just hate riding bikes in the rain. Everyone in Portland is just, like, glaring at me right now. I don't like riding bikes in the rain. I got, like, an hour behind everyone. I'm just, like, riding my poncho, like, at a mile an hour up this big muddy hill. I was like, and I finally caught up to everyone, like, hours and hours later, and I just looked off to the right, and then there was, like, 20 of my amazing friends all camped in this beautiful field of daisies, like, next to a creek. And then we had a campfire, and then Serena and Kurt both bought nail polish in town, like, separately, and so we had this wonderful nail party campfire next to a creek in a field of daisies.
Yeah.
And that was pretty magical, I have to say.
Well, it was drizzling here earlier. You know, you just put on some rain pants. But when I leave the studio and I ride in the rain, I'll think of you. And I don't want to say I'll send you some rain, but I'll invite you to come and ride with us here. In the drizzle.
It's been a personal project. I'm getting better.
Yeah. My only issue is the glasses. I just need like little windshield wipers on my glasses and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of leads into the question of like, you know, you said you were scanning through the photos in your mind from the trip. Like, is it one of those moments where the internet didn't lie to us and you guys really did have the most spectacular time?
Yeah, I don't think there was any like cropping out the sadness kind of stuff on this tour. it was pretty much sheer joy. I mean, every bike tour is going to have like some hard moments and everything, but all in all, it was as good as it looks on the internet. I, you know, won't always say that, but it was really magical. I just looked at some photos of the Morgan and Stephanie.
I saw those this morning. They were posted on Radovast, right?
Yeah, I had to miss that weekend in Missoula, so I actually missed the 40th anniversary for the most part because I had to start work earlier than I thought. And just seeing everyone, like, biking around town together and, like, 20 people at the coffee shop, I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah.
But just knowing, like, how, like, magical all those people are on their own and just trying to fathom them all being in the same place at the same time was pretty special. So, I feel really good about the summer. I can't really say more than it's just amazingly magical.
And what's next on your agenda? Do you also cycle around the world or sort of keep it to the U.S. and Canada?
I don't have any international plans. I may do the Grand Depart for the Baja Divide in January. Mm-hmm. A few of us are talking about doing that. But besides that, I don't have any international plans. I traveled internationally a little bit for a while, and then when I came back, I was just staggered by how much space and open there is just in the West and California alone. So I've been kind of focusing, just staying a little bit domestic for a while because there's still so much here to explore.
Well, that's exciting. Then, thank you so much for joining us. What your Instagram handle is? Spencer J. Harding, correct?
Yeah.
And then if we wanted to give our listeners some other options to kind of check about the ride, what other, you know, websites or places do you think that they should go?
Oh, man. Let's see. I mean, there's a few photo sets on the Radovist. There's one that I did with those photos from Locke and Mark and Benedict. So there's a photo set of the four of ours. The photos that Morgan just had up on the Radovist as well. If you just check out the hashtag DFL The Divide, there's like 20 of us, so you can see like everyone's photo.
Yeah, and then there was also something too on adventure cycling as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Whitney did a short blog post about that. That's on Adventure Cycling's website. There will be, if you're a member of Adventure Cycling, I've been in talks with the editor there, and we'll be doing an article in March, if I remember correctly, of some of my photos. There'll be a short photo essay in the Adventure Cyclist magazine in March.
Awesome. That sounds great. Yeah. And then where can people follow you and your adventures?
Oh, Instagram's probably the easiest way. I've been a terrible blog keeper besides that anymore these days.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much
thank
for joining
so much.
Us today. It's been a pleasure to see all the photos, and it was exciting to see that some are popping up still, as days go on. So enjoy your travels, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm so stoked to be had. It was wonderful chatting with you both, and thanks for reaching out.
And come and join us in the rain sometime.
Yes.
I will. I did not make it to Portland this summer, and I'm kind of bummed about it. So
it's still really beautiful in the winter here. I mean, not LA beautiful, but...
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye,
y'all. Bye. And then Alan has some local announcements to do.
Yes.
So I'm gonna go to him.
Two announcements here. The Portland Hawthorne Hostel is having its 13th annual bike-in movie. Each year since 2004, the Portland Hawthorne Hostel has hosted a unique celebration of all things bicycles. And that's been with the Bike and Movie event. The event is free and open to all. And it takes place on Saturday, September 24th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. And this year, there'll be a couple of films. The feature film will be the award-winning documentary Rising from Ashes, which is about the development of a national cycling team in Rwanda. Also, there'll be a DJ, DJ Angeli, and he'll be on hand to provide music. There'll also be free food and beverages. So that's on September 24th, 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel. And then the other event is another annual event, the ALICE Awards, organized by the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. It's accompanied by an auction, and that is also on September 24th, so hopefully you could make both. This is the BTA's biggest event of the year, celebrating their expanded mission, going statewide with a wonderful program called Safe Routes to School, as well as celebrating the people who have gone above and beyond to make our region one of the best places to bike, walk, and use transit. And something new this year, they're keeping the party going after the award ceremony with an after party called ALICE Encore. And this is an opportunity for even more friends to come celebrate and have fun. There will be dancing, lots of games, and also they'll be revealing their new brand. So if you want to learn more about this wonderful yearly event organized by the Portland, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and if you want to get tickets, please go to www.btaoregon.org/ALICE2016.
Great. Well, you have been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast live from Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Tori Bortman, Alon Robb, Terry Campbell, and myself, Meg Keys. And we'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests, Jasmine Reese from Fidgetpaw and adventure cyclist and photographer, Spencer Harding. We'll be back next month with more great bike news. And until then, make it a great day and keep spinning those wheels. Motion, all wheels moving all kind of ways. Indoors, outdoors, in the sun, there are people everywhere having fun, fun, fun. And when the moon and stars come out at night, we'll know what to do when we turn out the light. Turn out the light, out the light. The freeways there are jammed with all kind of folks on their bikes.
All right. It's 11:58 here at KBOO Portland, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Skyline Tavern Project, a not-for-profit historic saloon at the edge of Forest Park dedicated to supporting art and ecology through live music, food, and horseshoes. 8031 Northwest Skyline Boulevard and skytav.com. Also by Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 43 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. And that's it for morning programming here at KBOO.FM on the web, KBOO Portland. The time is, now it's 11:59, and we're going to move into jazz momentarily. Nick's ready to take over here, but that'll happen just after the KBOO news at noon. Thanks for tuning in.